Welcome to the Unofficial Guide to Partnering. In this podcast, Vince Minzione, a proven industry sales and partner executive, brings together technology leaders in this forum to discuss transformational trends and to deconstruct successful strategies to thrive and survive in the rapid age of cloud transformation. And now your host, Vince Minzione.
In this episode, I'm joined by Tony Savoyan, the CEO and president of SADA Systems, who speaks to the personal and professional journey of a family and immigrant-owned IT consultancy company. His exponential growth has been fueled by getting it right, partnering with both Microsoft and Google. Tony discusses how the business evolved from an early cloud IT company and where he sees the opportunity going. Tony also discusses his leadership philosophy and personal values. Tony, I'm really excited to have you on the podcast.
Vince, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be one of your first people being interviewed on this new podcast, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Now, it's great to have you. And you know, one of the goals for this podcast is to feature partners that have gotten it right, the companies that have figured out how to work with giants like Microsoft. And your story is so unique in that you focused not only dedicating your company to one, but to two industry giants, and in areas where they compete fiercely. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. It's a great question. It's something we get asked about by people like yourself who really intimately know the landscape and the nuance and the complexities with trying to do that. And of course, now we've somewhat complicated things by also adding Workplace by Facebook into our portfolio as a launch partner for that product. And I love to report that somehow we masterminded this 17 years ago when we formed the company. But like all things, there's always an element of serendipity and being in the right place at the right time. The irony is, when we started in 2000, you know, there was no cloud, there was no Google Enterprise, and we started as a traditional Microsoft partner. In fact, Hovik, my father and the founder, the first thing that he did was for a customer was build a FoxPro application. By 2003, we'd become a gold Microsoft partner. We launched what we think is one of the first sort of proactive managed services offerings in market in Southern California, which became very popular because it really aligned incentives, right? Our job became to prevent things from breaking at customer locations as opposed to sending them a big bill, charging hourly after they broke and their business was down. That, at the same time, made us enamored with this concept of recurring revenue, the consistency, the business model, the compound effect of winning customers and keeping them for life was a powerful model. And then, you know, we went forward from there, ran into some limitations about scale and growth. How do you scale out of one territory? It became, you know, logistically complicated, expensive to have all the people in the field and the trucks and the equipment and all that stuff. We're a very local SMB IT shop back then. When we ran into this limitation, though, you know, at the same time, sort of dot-com era SAP, ASP model was kind of in its infancy. Microsoft had great technologies like Terminal Server and Citrix was out there. So we thought a solution to scale would be to, and we call this offering zero infrastructure. Like, you know, we thought, what would it be like if we're able to co-locate Exchange and Office and just serve it to not just Southern California customers, but to anyone from a central location? Not only could we expand geographically without having to have a lot of boots on the ground, but if we were to centralize the core of the infrastructure, we also wouldn't have to go to all these offices all the time because there would be nothing essentially that could break. That was, I think, also pretty novel as a concept at the time. We immediately ran into, I think, what even the biggest hosters today are running into, whether it's Rackspace or anybody else in the sort of data center game, which is, and we ran into it very early on a small scale, but we're like, wow, boy, is it expensive to build this infrastructure centrally. And boy, is it difficult to provide four nines of reliability in a multi-tenant environment. So we convinced two of our managed customers to give it a try in sort of this beta. We discovered how difficult it was. We actually rolled them back into an on-premise environment, thankfully keeping both of them as customers in the process, I think, due to our, you know, sort of complete dedication to service and support. Supporting great relationships, they were tolerant of this exercise. But then, so we, you know, stepped back and kept thinking about what we're going to do next. We're selling a lot of equipment and hardware to our managed customers, trying to give a one throat to choke, white glove experience with all their needs. I think that was a good part of the model. But incidentally, sometimes as these things go, I ran into this Google Enterprise Search Partnership ad, I think, or search appliance ad in some airline magazine. And my first thought was, Google has an enterprise business, you know, and of course it was in its infancy at the time. Google was the number one consumer brand on the Forbes list last year. This was about 2005 or 2006. I had to convince Hovik that we should become a partner for this, despite the fact that it cost $10,000 to join at a time where the Microsoft Gold partnership was $800 a year, you know. But I'm really glad we did, because as we entered that partnership for this search technology, that was essentially the concept of using Google's search technology and power to find information behind the firewall. Google started to learn about our Microsoft capabilities and code and infrastructure because, you know, we wrote some connectors for the search appliance. That business in itself at the time was an epic failure, because our average customer was maybe 15 employees, and no 15 employee company was about to spend $35,000 on a search box to find what they have. No. They had it on a hard drive somewhere and that was sufficient. But as these things go, the benefit of that was this 50 or 100 person enterprise team at Google at the time in its infancy was getting ready to launch something else. Google Apps for Your Domain is what they called it. They came to us, tapped us on the shoulder and said, hey, you guys know this Microsoft stuff. We don't know anybody else who does. If you do these 10 things, we'll make you a launch partner. When the product launches, you'll be a launch partner. There'll be 7 in North America. So ironically, it was a Microsoft partnership that led us to be a launch partner with Google. And then the irony sort of continues in that around 2009, Microsoft noticed our work in the Google space, and they came to us in the SoCal region. I'll never forget Eric Trimble, Jane Dixon. We're sort of confused, but very curious about who we were. Came to our office and said, what are you guys doing with this Google stuff? You're my gold partner with Microsoft. And I said, well, they have cloud stuff and you don't. So that's why, and we believe in this model. At the time, there was no resale. It was mostly for the higher education market, where Google was giving it away, as they still do. And we're doing a lot of those implementations. But they said, you know, we are coming out with something called BPaaS. A lot of our traditional partners don't understand it. They're kind of scared of it. You know, it has some issues. There's some pain. It's new. We're like, we're in. You know, we get it. We have no commitment to the on-premise world. It's not a huge business for us. We understand instinctually this is where we're going. Why? Because we tried to do it ourselves in 2005 and failed. And then, of course, we became essentially a launch partner for BPaaS, which led to 365. And because of our dedication to the cloud model, we just ran very quickly. So Microsoft traditional partnership led to Google Cloud partnership. Google Cloud partnership led to the Microsoft Cloud partnership. Microsoft and Google launch capabilities led to a phone call from, you know, somebody at Facebook who worked at Google for many years and knew of us and asked us to be launch partner for that.
It's amazing.
And we all came together.
It's amazing. You know, I remember our first time together or with your team was when you were being recognized by our education team as partner of the year at our event, and that you were known then mostly as a Google partner, but you had set up a live at EDU practice working with the education team at Microsoft.
Oh, yes.
So the perception of being the Google partner, and now I understand the story of how you were Microsoft first, then Google, then Microsoft again, and how one helped launch the other. But how did you overcome with the Microsoft teams that Google perception? And is it something that you still face?
So it's actually, we have to overcome that bias or that element of maybe mistrust, right, on both sides. And in the beginning, I remember making that call to Scott McMullen at the time and telling them we're about to be announced as a BPaaS partner. This is a Google guy who's managing our relationship. I think transparency and being forthright is very important. But then we did something else that's very novel and quite rare, and we continue to do that, which is we decided very early on that because of the competitive nature of these two solutions and because of really the perception of the field, it's not even just like, of course, we have to manage those relationships and build that level of trust, but we knew that if there was mistrust in the field, the decision about which partners get engaged in each opportunity is an audible at the time of that event right then and there, and that rep and that rep's manager have a lot of sway in terms of who is their partner of choice. So we knew that to be successful, we had to segment and divide the sales organizations to build a team that had its own VP of sales that was 100% Microsoft sales team, and then following, you know, 100% Microsoft delivery team and pre-sales engineering team and dev team, and the same thing on the Google side. We still have that today. We also have rules of engagements about how we treat those opportunities in terms of cross-selling and things like that, which we don't do. Even doing that still was, you know, every time there was press about one, the other would be worried. There was a time where one of those guys, I won't mention which, was really trying to convince us that we just split these organizations. My father takes one, I take the other, which we were kind of, you know, almost thinking about for a moment. Then I think smartly decided that was not a path to success. But we're so dedicated in the field with those sellers. If we're in the deal with a Microsoft rep, with one of our Microsoft reps, we live and die with that rep in that deal. And we're not like the traditional SI, especially the big SIs, which is, you know, we open up the jacket pocket and say, you know, which cloud do you want? I'll sell anything. And I think that was and continues to be a tremendous differentiator that builds trust.
So not partner agnostic, not technology agnostic, but dedicated, committed to each of the brands. And then firewalled, right? As I think I heard you know, didn't use that word, but firewalled is a term that is commonly used in contracting for separating the two organizations and the knowledge base.
And a documented rules of engagement manifesto that says, if we're in a deal, Brandon on the Microsoft side with somebody on the Microsoft side is in a deal, and we lose that deal, they decide to do something else. If the CIO or somebody calls us and says, hey, I didn't want Microsoft, sell me Google, we'll say no.
I recently read an interview with your mom about the genesis of the company. The company was founded by both your mom and dad.
Yes.
And then you joined the company and you're now the CEO and president of the company. Tell our listeners what it's like to work with both parents on a day-to-day basis and who takes direction from whom.
It's an interesting question. Another one, which, you know, I was kind of working at this .com in Orange County. I was finishing school at UC Irvine, and this .com was about to be defunded like everyone else back in, you know, 2000. And my father had just started SADA. My mother already had this graphic design business, which is mostly a sole proprietorship at the time. You know, when they were getting defunded, I had other options to go work elsewhere. But sort of culturally, the thing to do is to move back to LA and, you know, help the family in terms of, you know, where do I exercise my energy and talent. But I'm an only child, and they have all their eggs in one basket. And even though I didn't know, you know, anything from anything back then, the one thing I knew was that the right thing to do for me and my family would be to move home, literally into my bedroom, which was my office, work for $0 an hour, which I did the first year. I think second year I was making $8 an hour or something like that. But look, when it works well, it's absolutely the best framework for any kind of partnership. You're adding value into what is the future and the legacy of your family. Now that I have kids, I think about that, the responsibility of setting them up. And of course, as an immigrant family, that we're guided by one thing, which is leaving the next generation with a better table stakes than we had. But, you know, it's not without its challenges. I mean, it's very difficult to not agree on certain things. And yes, I became the CEO in 2003 when my mother's company merged with my dad's, which makes sense because I had the sort of graphic capabilities and my dad had the software and infrastructure kind of capabilities. But also, SADA was formed with my dad and, you know, three other partners. And at the same time, the three other partners, they were all part-time, by the way. We were not making enough money for them to leave their other jobs and join SADA full-time. But so they were, you know, bought out at the time, and that's when I became CEO. But your dad's your dad. You know, he can play the dad card anytime.
What happens when you have conviction about something they don't agree with?
There's a lot of healthy debate, which is hard to sometimes not take personally. But what's special about my family and my parents specifically, a lot of partnerships and family partnerships, you know, are also subject to this, is when there's a debate, it's usually about money or whatever. The orientation of my parents and my family is that it's not, it's never about that. And so that's nice, because I know that that in itself can be highly distracting and disruptive and toxic when you're really talking about who makes what and, you know, who owns what. It was never about that. When we have disagreements, it's really almost sort of this generational philosophical disagreement about how they think about the world, you know. And I understand, you know, growing up in sort of a Soviet era Armenia, and even I grew up there for several years, but you know, that mentality versus the modern paradigm, which is, you know, my job is to push that agenda forward. Those are the kind of things that we disagree about, and usually the right thing happens. Usually the truth and the right decision is somewhere in the middle. But we also now over time have, you know, gathered a great management team at different levels, and their opinion matters. And, you know, we sort of crowdsource to the best possible outcome. And even though some of their orientation may sound and feel old school, and there's a lot of wisdom in that mentality. And I can't discount that because it sounds old school. There's so much wisdom there.
Yeah, it sounds like a great balance between new and old. One of the things that, you know, I'm going to shift to the Microsoft relationship here a second, and the evolution of the Microsoft relationship. Your company became a national solution provider or NSP partner to Microsoft just a few years ago. And on a previous podcast, we had Eric Loper, who discussed the NSP program.
Oh, yes, I love Eric.
And we do too. But as you know, this is a significant designation. It's limited to a select group of maybe 30 to 40 partners who have significant set of competencies, commitment to the platform, and can scale across the business. Maybe you can take our listeners through your journey to get there. You know, was that conscious? Did you focus on that specific designation or not? Or was there a set of steps that you took to attain that level of growth?
That's a great question. So the first thing that happened when we chose to launch with BPOS is we became regionally managed, you know, which makes sense. Most of our business was here. And so, again, becoming managed at all was a huge change in terms of our co-engagement, go-to-market motion with Microsoft. That made a significant difference to our business. And I'll forever be thankful to Jane Dixon, and who you know well, and Eric Trimble, who you know well, that believed in this diamond in the rough that, you know, conventional wisdom would say, you know, don't partner with these guys. And then they saw through that. We were sort of asked at some point, I think 2 years into the being SoCal managed, to potentially join the NSP portfolio. And is absolutely a distinction and an honor to have just been asked. But we were also kind of, it was balanced with this, you know what this means, right? A different set of obligations, a different set of commitments, a lot of eyeballs, there's a lot at stake, that kind of stuff. And you have to work really hard. And we did ultimately, you know, say yes, because we saw a tremendous opportunity there. And we were becoming a national practice. So becoming part of the NSP portfolio was both a great opportunity in terms of becoming part of this sort of elite North America, you know, 30, 35 partners that Microsoft believes are, you know, the most, you know, closely managed, given a lot of opportunities to do novel things, but also this brand, you know, being able to go to market and talk to customers about how we're part of this group, also came with a lot of responsibility. Now we're essentially responsible for a certain revenue number, and our performance is very closely managed. But we were becoming a national provider. And that's another thing that clouds changed for us, even going back to the Google days. We were a SoCal-based IT shop. In 2007, we launched with Google as a partner. Our first Google project was Northwestern University. And we did the whole thing remotely, never even went there. And, you know, that's what cloud enables, this element of scale where you're not, you don't have to physically be everywhere to do the kind of work that traditional IT projects required. So that made sense. Today, even we did this exercise, I think for tax purposes, but you'd be surprised, even though we have maybe 150 of our 170 people sitting in LA, only 15% of our revenue comes from California-based clients. So we're very national.
And as you said, you can do quite a bit remotely with the cloud in deployments and the like in services. And then you manage those customers too. You mentioned the managed service portfolio. Is that something you offer to all of your customers?
You know, it was one of our first businesses, right, that we saw success in. And we feel that, you know, the tail engagement and staying close with customers is so important beyond the initial project that, of course, we try to attach managed services as much as possible to whether it's maintenance and support for a custom piece of SharePoint development or CRM or it's infrastructure management. What's interesting is, since you touched upon this, is there was a tremendous paradigm happening to our core business, traditional business of the traditional on-premise managed services was like, well, we're going to charge $500 a month to maintain this Exchange environment. Guess what? Part of what we're great at is removing that Exchange environment and moving it to the cloud. So we even had to kind of, you know, re-architect and reframe the value of managed services in the world of cloud. And, you know, we continue on that journey today. But what's great is I think people understand that if something is in the cloud, it doesn't mean that it no longer needs to be managed. And so we continue on that evolutionary journey of our own capabilities and new offerings, but also really educating the market about what that means. But managed services continues to be paramount.
You know, there's a lot of partners out there trying to figure it out. Is there one thing you would offer up to our listeners looking to engage with Microsoft? Was there an attribute or attributes that set you apart? In other words, what was like your secret sauce, if you don't mind me asking?
I think to some degree is being all in. You know, if you understand that this is where you're going, and this is where a lot of Microsoft partners, you know, hesitated, they had this orientation of, well, let's wait until the market is proven out and we're making too much money in this on-premise world. We're going to wait. And I think that's why, you know, every paradigm shift, and we're going through another couple that, you know, it continues to shift. The paradigms continue to shift, but every shift creates new winners and new losers. And it's about seeing where the puck is going, investing heavily with no comms, because you have so much conviction about what the future is. And we had no doubts that the future is public cloud. And that's what Microsoft liked. We didn't have this identity crisis about, we really need to keep the server on-premise because we need to charge $500 a month forever because that's our core business. We're like, you know what? If we don't move that server today, somebody else will 3 years from now.
Yeah. You were already there. It didn't take convincing.
Mentally, philosophically, we were there. Absolutely.
Yep. So you mentioned the successful relationship with Google. And even when I look on your webpage, you have separate pages for the Microsoft case studies and the Google case studies spotlighting some of the wins. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the partnership with Google? How does that relationship differentiate between the one you have with Microsoft? What's different about it? What's similar about it?
Great question. So one of the things that we absolutely, again, were enamored with back in 2002, 2003 was recurring revenue. And what Google did, I think, in their wisdom, not having the legacy of different licensing models and the LSPs, of course, and you know, all that's being challenged today with CSP. But one of the things Google did really right out of the gate is when they were shifting away from just giving Gmail away free to higher ed and wanting to address the commercial markets, that from day one, they allowed us to resell the subscription on our paper and be the billing relationship, first line of support, et cetera, to these commercial customers. And that's what we continue to absolutely love about the Google framework, is there's not a lot of channel conflict with regards to how these customers transact and buy. The go-to motion is on partner paper. Not every partner that they have, especially the big SIs now, do resell, but we always have. And that's been a great catalyst for our growth. People are wondering, you know, how can you grow 40% a year every year for 10 years? It's the, you know, compound effect of recurring revenue over time with an absolute focus on customer retention and, you know, upgrades and maintenance of those relationships and those contracts. That's how you do it. When Microsoft used to meet with us, so when are you going to stop, you know, stop selling Google, or sell less Google, sell more Microsoft? I said, well, it'll help if you let me resell. Right. And that was the battle. And then all of a sudden CSP came out and we're a launch partner for CSP. We're like, finally, the model that makes sense. And the reason that it makes sense in the world of consumption economics with regards to partners is that if subscription and revenue and retention and consumption is important to the vendor, it has to be important to the partner. We have to be driven by the same incentive. It drives the right behavior. we can't have this sort of 3A buying, 3-year EA buying cycle when they own, you know, whatever SharePoint 2010 at the time, but never deploy it. And no one cares that they don't deploy it, right? This is consumption economics. If they don't deploy it and don't consume it, they're going to turn it off. So that's what Google got really right, and Microsoft starting to with CSP. There's still some conflict there. It takes a lot of time to dismantle a $60 billion 30-year-old architecture around licensing.
Not to mention a big revenue stream for the company.
$60 billion or whatever it was, you know, through that framework. And it's being dismantled slowly, we believe. We know that Microsoft believes that CSP is the future. It's a hero go-to-market motion, but you know, it takes time to dismantle that.
You mentioned shifting paradigms and continually shifting paradigms. Can you expand on that one a little bit? Does that have to do anything with the relationship with Microsoft or Google or Facebook?
Both. All three. What? This is the interesting journey. You know, when a product first comes out, a solution first comes out, the partner value proposition hasn't been defined, and we have to find, okay, where do we add value now? And 10 years ago, where we added value for Google, believe it or not, was there was no migration tools. There was no directory synchronization tools. There's no single sign-ons or authentication tools. The value we provided, when you engage with SADA, you got one engineer who did these things for you. And that was it. Over time, as those tools became more prevalent and less of a differentiator, what became important was excellent project execution and delivery. So we're like, wow, okay, so now we need a great PMO. So then you got a PM and an engineer. And then we're like, well, the technical stuff's pretty easy. Execution's straightforward. What we really need is adoption and change management, because my God, I'm for 10,000 employees. I'm about to change the user experience for the most widely used and important software for 100% of my employees. They're going to come in on Monday, and on Friday it was Lotus, and on Monday it's going to be Google. What are we going to do? So then we have to become great at adoption and change management. So now you got a different kind of team. And that's the same, you know, on the Microsoft and the Google side. And now we're kind of entering this other paradigm, which a lot of people can deploy Office 365 or Google relatively well. In fact, in the Microsoft world, Fast Track will do it for you. So what's the differentiator and the paradigm shift today is we need UX, UI people, we need business analysts, data scientists, all this stuff. Because if you define kind of what SADA is about, it's really two things. One is getting customers to the cloud, which every year we think, well, that's going to slow down, but it's not. We still have, you know, only 5% of the existing IT workloads in the public cloud relative to, you know, existing IT infrastructure and spend. So still tons and tons of migration work to do. Phase two for us is, and for our customers, the real opportunity where the real transformation happens, which is once you're in the cloud, what can you do that you could not do before that's sort of essentially transformational for your organization, that creates a differentiator and a market advantage for you as a customer relative to everyone else. Because migrating to, you know, my email off of Exchange to 365 or to Google in itself is good, but the real transformation happens is when line of business starts to engage in a real dialogue with the CIO about what can we do now that we couldn't do before or we have been unable to do before. Because the technology wasn't there or affordable, because these things like BI and big data and these, you know, these were exclusive, you know, to the Fortune 500, and nobody else could do it. Microsoft and Google are changing that by providing these things by the SIP, so everybody can do it.
So give us an example of that. I mean, we know about big data, we know about AI and BI. What are some of the things you're seeing from your customers?
I'll start with the most fundamental light bulb moment when we were a 700 employee entertainment firm in LA. They paid $50,000 to migrate to Exchange. Then they spent $1.1 million on SharePoint. We're like, wow. Okay. This is a new paradigm. And this is like 3-4 years ago. And that became evident to me that to be successful in a new paradigm, we cannot just differentiate ourselves in our ability to migrate. That is our table stakes. I still think we do it better than anyone else. We just had a great success story on stage with Colgate and Mike Crowe giving us a shout out and making this possible for them. Again, the emphasis that he made wasn't about like we solved great technical challenges. We did. but it was like the adoption and training and change management really nailed that. And that's where a lot of cloud projects today are, you know, that's where they can succeed or fail, is an adoption part, not the technical part. But and that was the moment back then. So it's an entertainment firm, like line of business has the big budgets. They have the big ambitions. They have been told no for the last 20 years by the CIO's office because they couldn't afford the technology they needed to accomplish the things that they wanted, and they didn't have the skill set. Now, my thesis, and this is for your audience, you're talking about, you know, how to be a great partner and be successful in this new paradigm. My thesis is that what I call the mid-market, which is maybe in our definition 500 to 10,000 user employees, they're finally serviced by the technology vendors because of public cloud. Microsoft, Google, others have democratized technology. Anybody can do machine learning. They finally have that. Before, they didn't have that. It was great SMB software, default enterprise software like SAP, Oracle, IBM, nothing in the middle, really. Microsoft Office, yes, but not much else. So now they have that, but they still don't have sophisticated, enterprise-capable SIs and partners that they don't have. There's not enough of us to help the line of business on this journey. Come together with the CIO's office, put the CIO in the forefront as the hero, and using this technology, make big transformational things happen. That, I think, is the next challenge. And then why I think it will create another set of new winners and losers, because some have made the journey, a lot have made the journey into being able to migrate to the cloud. Most have not in our world, as far as our competitors. But the next set of winners or losers will be defined by those who are able to execute on step two, not migration to the cloud, but step two, which is doing transformational things in the cloud.
And you mentioned an interesting point, democratization of data, I believe is the way you refer to it. But that just the ability now that you have the access to the data to take and transform or inform on the business in ways that could not be done before.
I mean, I'll talk about a couple. So Wash Laundry, which I was on stage with at WPC in 2015 with Judson, demonstrating what today seems like a pretty rudimentary Power BI presentation. Wash Laundry is a... they provide washer and dryers for multi-family and university environments. What they have now, by virtue of the sort of democratization of technology, is they have 400,000 washers and dryers in 70,000 locations, all internet connected, providing data about all sorts of things. Now, the cost of internet connecting devices has certainly gone down, but prior to cloud, there's no way you could centralize and store this data in a way that was useful and affordable. Because of Azure, they're able to do that. And what they do with that data is pretty remarkable, including things that create the level of advantage such that when one of their machines breaks, their repair time, in-field response time, repair time is 11 hours. The closest competitor, it's 4 days. The competitor, their machine is down for 4 days. Every hour is costing them money. Like, that's one example. Of just gathering and surfacing this sort of data and a Power BI and machine learning capabilities to predict when machines might break, or to be able to assess which make and model of machines are more reliable than others, or which markets are more geared towards coin and cash versus credit cards, or where to put the next set of machines. That's extremely valuable competitive advantage sort of data. I'll give you another one, which is even more magical. And it actually also speaks to the fact that we're no longer talking in terms of cost shifting in IT spend. We're not doing things we used to do before. I'll give you an example, as you know, intimately, because you were there when Skype for Business launched with Microsoft. We were told Skype for Business is a $50 billion North America opportunity. We're like, wow, big number. They know that number. How do they know that number? Well, they add up all the spend on Cisco and Mitel and Avaya and Nortel and carriers, and they come with a number, right? They spend on X, now they're going to spend on Y. What some of our customers are doing, for instance, in healthcare is, you know, they're trying to create the world's preeminent genomics research platform running in the cloud that allow any, because they're a nonprofit, allow any research institution to use that framework for their own genomics data processing. It's like not, it's, you know, so what is that market opportunity? We don't know. Nobody knows. The best analysts don't know, because it's not like, well, we used to use SAP to cure cancer and now we're using Google Cloud. No, you just couldn't do it before. How big is it? Nobody knows. After 10 years, Vince, we're still in the second inning.
Interesting that you mentioned healthcare. I know firsthand that years ago, you didn't have a Microsoft healthcare practice. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
And congratulations, you were just up on stage at the big healthcare IT event, HIMSS, yes, being recognized by the Microsoft team for your work there in healthcare. How did that happen? How did you go from zero to up on stage in such a short time?
It's partly our execution, but partly market dynamics. And what's interesting is on the Google side also, we've done like 17 hospital groups now. Our story, I mean, on the HIMSS with Dr. Lee's doing at CHLA is just tremendous, completely enabled by cloud technology and Skype. But a couple of different things are happening. So I think 5 or 6 years ago, even maybe 3 years ago, there was a couple industries that were absolutely sort of averse to this concept of cloud. Financial services was one, legal was one, healthcare was another one. They were so protective of their data. They thought they would have to hoard that data in their on-premise systems, et cetera. But I think another paradigm shift, sort of mental shift that has occurred is these organizations are now realizing that they cannot do security better than the public cloud companies. Some some verticals, like let's say manufacturing, if some manufacturing company, let's say Superior Industries, who makes wheels, they get hacked, it's bad, maybe cost them some money. It's not front page news. Something happens in healthcare, it absolutely is front page news with hefty penalties, right, that they have to suffer. Now that they've realized Google and Microsoft can do security and data protection better than they can, it was evident to me when, the State Department looked at and actually bought Google at the time because they couldn't get hackers out of their Exchange system for 9 months, that if the State Department can't do it, the average healthcare organization can't do it. Nobody can do it. Because of that mind shift, healthcare is now one of the most active verticals in this discussion around making the first step, the primary step to the cloud, just with their email data, and of course, then following other things. And that's really the market shift that's happened. It's no longer a debate whether Google and Microsoft and Facebook can protect your data better than you can. It's pretty much a given.
And then it's what you do with that data once you have it in the cloud. And you, as you mentioned, the healthcare opportunity is just so huge.
Completely untapped.
Untapped. Hey, let's shift a little bit here and talk about Tony and what makes you tick.
As CEO of a dynamic 40% annualized growth company, what is your leadership style like?
Good question. I think you sort of alluded to this family business thing. I think that was a stigma that we had to overcome over time, because this concept of a family business, traditionally, when you hear family business, you think hokey, non-professional, so on and so forth, right? I think because of our company performance and our growth and our ability to execute, that sort of stigma has mostly fallen by the wayside. There's still kind of weird, parents-child stuff that comes out in meetings and things once in a while. There's some views of that. But we don't let it get in the way of our execution, obviously. But for me, it's, Vince, I feel so fortunate to have been in this position that I feel a couple things. One is, we're not just participants in this market with Google, Microsoft, Facebook, public cloud. We are in the front lines creating this market with them. To some degree, not to kind of overplay our contribution to the market, but we feel like it's our responsibility to continue to push this forward for our customers, for the market, for and with our partners. We've been given this chance, and I'm wise enough to know that, in a lifetime, you may get one chance like this. If you're lucky, maybe two. Not even Oprah Winfrey could make the OWN network profitable and successful when she tried to do something other than her show, right?
Right, that's right.
So I'm not naive to think that I'm an Elon Musk or something like that can, change 4 or 5 industries in a lifetime. Certainly we're not that. I'm not that. We have a responsibility to try to push this forward as far as we can, as far as we're able to, because this opportunity is unique. I owe it to our employees, we owe it to our customers, we owe it to our partners, frankly, and the market. Because when you do even simple things, like when you help 600,000 students from Chicago public schools, which is mostly in sort of, you know, not the most wealthy demographic, all of a sudden gain access to the same technology that the Fortune 500 can have, that they can access with a $300 computer, $200 computer at home. And they're doing all these things that prepares them for maybe a different trajectory in the future in their life, or we're doing an LAUSD or even healthcare. It's extremely rewarding. Now, there's a lot of ways to make money. You could own a fast food joint and make money, right? But the fact that we're doing this and are successful and are literally changing lives is extremely motivating. You know, it's like it's purpose driven. Just like my parents, I think philosophy and orientation about the financial success element, that in itself is only a driver from the standpoint of we all want to discover what our natural limits are as a CEO, as a leader. You know, how big can we take something before we're just no longer qualified? So that's sort of my journey right now. But it comes with a great sense of responsibility. We have 170 employees and families, maybe another 1,000 people outside of SADA that depend on our ability to execute and do the right things and make the right decisions every day. That's what really drives us. And it's just super exciting to not be, we're in IT, which is the fastest moving sector of any industry, I think, any vertical. But we're not only in IT, we're on the tip of IT and technology. We're on the very tip of the fastest moving part of any sector. Our ability to be nimble and move fast, and partly by virtue of being a privately held small company, we don't have to, you know, get board approval and create a 50, you know, page slide deck and wait 4 months to start a Facebook partnership, let's say. You know, I think we want to continue taking advantage of this world where it's the fast that eat the slow. It's not the big that eat the small. And let's see how far we can take it and how much of the world we can impact.
What's a great piece of advice someone's given you on this journey, growing the business, creating impact?
Focus. There's a lot of shiny objects. We say no a lot. It's really important. Conviction. When you believe in something and you have a good lens, don't let people tell you you can't do something. And part of our success, I swear, even from day one, was a sense of almost naivete that I had about what was not possible, what couldn't work. Somewhat beneficial in this paradigm. And that we didn't have these sort of sacred cows. And the other thing now, honestly, it's something I continuously work on is, you know, staying driven, staying humble, accepting the fact that this is an extremely fortunate position to be in. You know, it's our responsibility to stay grounded as we continue to grow and do these great things with great customers. And I think that's a sort of a personal challenge for any leader who's an immigrant and now has experienced some success, but also a cultural element that I want to maintain at SADA across the board, that element of humility and self-awareness and in a world that is very fast and exciting and introduces parts of business and life that we haven't seen before. And I think that's something that we just have to have a great degree of self-awareness around it and stay grounded through the journey.
What from a hurdles perspective, like what are the things you've had to overcome either personally or professionally? What have been the real big obstacles, the big blockers for you in this journey?
Professionally has been the ability to sometimes not listen to your partners, even though you enter this thing with, you know, a relationship with Microsoft and Google for the first time. And the initial orientation is a sense of awe, like, wow, these people know everything. I know nothing. They're infinitely wise. But if I counted the number of times they've told us that we couldn't do something, and then we went in and did it and executed, like, you know, on the Google side, you can't have a Google and a Microsoft practice that's successful. Or, oh, you're an email migration guy. You can't possibly form an enterprise search business. Or you're an enterprise search business with, you know, Google capabilities. You can't sell maps. You have to be a GIS expert with PhDs in geography to sell maps. You know, globally, the number one maps partner for 4 years in a row with no such people on our team. So it's that, which again requires some element of sort of swagger and sort of an irrational sense of confidence sometimes, but you have to balance that with an element of humility, because if you take that too far, it's not who we want to be. And I think on the personal side, that's been my biggest challenge. When you, I think it was I was a philosophy major in school, right? It was Aristotle or Plato that said, if you want to destroy a man, give him 20 years of good fortune.
So what would you tell your 25-year-old self?
I would say continue to execute on what you believe in. That's it. And hire the best people that you can, always.
What pursuits or obsessions do you explore when you're not working? And I know we're friends on Facebook, so I know your family's very important to you. So outside of your family, what pursuits or obsessions do you explore when you're not working?
I love to travel and explore. I'm actually excited about tomorrow taking the journey with my kids to New York for the first time. They've never been to the Big Apple, and we're also taking them to DC. I think, you know, I attribute a lot of who I am and the fact that even maybe SADA exists by virtue of the fact that I decided to do a year abroad program, my third year of university, convinced by my philosophy professor at the time, this Italian guy, Ermanno Bencivenga, who I was in awe of every time I saw speak. He convinced me I should do a year abroad program. I think even though I was born in a different country, I think by the time I was, you know, 18, 19, I had certainly some element of tunnel vision. Love that perspective we get when we spend a serious amount of time in other places. I want to maintain that for myself and my family, because it's easy to get tunnel vision in the United States, and even in LA or California, you forget what the rest of the world is like or what they think. So I love that. I also like cars. I like fast cars. Fast cars are fun. Driving fast is fun.
What's your favorite car right now?
I'm a fan of convertible German automobiles.
We'll leave it there.
But that's it. I mean, my family. Family is number one. You're a family guy yourself. We're doing this all for them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That Italian culture is very similar than the Armenian culture.
Absolutely.
What did you want to be when you were growing up?
I was told to become a doctor.
Told to become a doctor.
For Armenian immigrants, there's only one real job in the world, and that's to become a doctor. But the irony is, you know, my father, he's an old school Soviet era trained engineer in the ground back then, building mainframe data centers, writing COBOL and Borland code. We always had technology in the house, which is one reason I think I have a natural instinct around it. We've always had it. That was not presented as a career option for me. But the reason that the third year was transformational is that was a year that I made up my mind that I did not want to become a doctor. And I met some people that were studying business and economics. These guys, you know, ended up in Accenture and other places. But that opened my eyes to other possibilities. And that's what happens when you take yourself out of this comfort zone, this sort of inertia that we're all living in, right? Perspective is important.
Absolutely.
As a year, I decided I did not want to become a doctor. And to some degree, that's my year abroad is why SADA exists in the first place.
Who is one of your role models, and what advice or attributes did you learn from them?
My father certainly continues to be really smart, just a lot of wisdom, will do anything for his family, for his family, the biggest heart, the best entertainer. You definitely want to go to his house for a barbecue when he invites you. My mother, who has an infinite amount of empathy and love, unconditional love. My grandfather, my mother's dad, actually, who was maybe one of the world's first Renaissance men, maybe one of Armenia's first Renaissance men, in the way that he thought about, you know, he had three daughters, the way he thought about women. And he taught my grandmother to drive in Armenia in the 50s, which no women were doing, partly because he liked to go out and party and wanted a designated driver, I think, but still wise. Now that I have my girls, and I see that how he set up his three girls, he set them up for success and independence and education. It was very progressive at the time. And that's why I think I chose the wife that I chose and have the kind of kids that I have, is because, you know, my grandfather taught me that respect and view of women, and I think is more relevant than ever now in terms of technology in our sector. Right? We're always talking about why are there not more women in our industry, and I think that's tremendously valuable. But I also look at, you know, guys like, of course, Jobs and Gates and Elon Musk. I'm a big Tesla fan. I own two of them. These people that are not afraid to buck the trends and buck the system. I think it's impossible to become the quote unquote best in something, Vince. You know that. Not become the best or the biggest or whatever. What you can become is something that is in a category of one. And I think that's really the key to success. You have to become unique and exceptional, not the biggest or best, because that's, you can't do that. And I think the kind of things that all those people have done, even parts of my family, I look at members of my family like, wow, these so unique in their orientation. I think running a company is kind of the same way. We have to become a category one to be successful.
You know, you mentioned women and women in technology, which brought up an interesting point. Do you consciously try to recruit women into your organization? And if so, do you find that more difficult to find people with the technical skills?
I wouldn't say specifically and consciously like a big company would. I definitely still believe that part of the respect that we have to show women and our immigrant friends and everybody else is having an even playing field. I don't expect to, you know, isolate women's requirements and qualifications and set some artificial quotas around that. What I'm really happy to see in our all hands, I show this picture of a snapshot of SADA, I think in 2006. We had one woman working at SADA. No, we had two. We had my mother and this intern. Now we have tons of women in leadership roles, and that wasn't intentional per se. And the fact that, yeah, we have some, you know, great developers, some technical people that are women, certainly some of our best. But what's great is like as our requirements and needs have evolved, like there's certain areas that have traditionally women have gravitated more towards. I think if you go to engineering school, UCLA or USC now, you see a huge degree of women, huge percentage of women. But I mean, we have a tremendous amount of incredible women working here. And again, as someone who came out of this world where I was surrounded by rock star, amazing, independent women, from my grandma to my mother to my aunts. And that's why I picked the wife that I picked, and so on and so forth. And my daughters, I see the potential in them to sort of be able to inject that into our culture and our success is very gratifying.
I have two more questions for you. If you could have a big billboard on the freeway in Los Angeles, what would it say?
What it would have, I'm going to send you this picture. What it would have is a live stream shot of the event last week at San Francisco, the Google Next event, where I knew that the CIO of Colgate was, you know, supposed to mention our work with them on the big stage. I also didn't realize it was being live streamed, but I was sitting there sort of biting my fingernails because you never know, last minute he could forget or choose not to mention SADA. None of the other customers that went up there mentioned their partners. And the moment he mentioned SADA, I literally stood up, did two fist bumps in the air and said back down, fist bumps. And lo and behold, it was caught on a live stream. And I started getting these pings like, was that you? Because I could recognize a profile, I think, with the hair. And I was like, yeah, that was me. Wow. Like, it was on a live stream. So I got this great snapshot of that. And what's great is on stage, there's like these three quotes that were kind of Colgate employees reacting to the announcement that they're going to go Google in the cloud. I'll send this to you, Vince, but the one that is caught in the frame is almost like a thought bubble of what I'm thinking in that moment, which is something about my ears are getting teary. Did I say my eyes are getting teary?
Oh, your eyes are getting teary.
I'll send you the snapshot. I think you'll get a kick out of it. That would be the billboard.
I would love it. So one last question. What is one thing that we don't teach, but you believe is true in successfully partnering with Microsoft and Google?
What they don't teach, and I think what most partners don't get, is that we have to orient ourselves in a framework that is completely instead of aligned with the objectives of our partners. What that means to us in a very fundamental way, Vince, is that we're not simply focused on maximizing our services revenue and all these services. And services are great. We want to do great services. But we're kind of like the anti- big SI. The big SIs want to get, you know, $10 of services for every $1 to Microsoft or Google. We're literally the opposite. We know that if we drive revenue to Google and revenue to Microsoft and consumption and revenue to Facebook, we will be successful. That is a key differentiator that nobody teaches, but it's absolutely fundamental to how we think. It's what's created a great recurring revenue stream and also our relative position in the stacking of partners, because we're so focused on that.
Tony, I want to thank you for taking the time out. I know how busy your schedule is, obviously growing a business, traveling, building partnerships. I want to thank you for joining me today. It's been a privilege to have you on.
Thanks again for the opportunity, Vince. I hope your listeners enjoy our chat.
I'm sure they will. Thanks again.
Talk to you later.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Unofficial Guide to Partnering with your host, Vince Minzione, online at unofficialguidetopartnering.com and facebook.com/unofficialguidetopartnering. We'll catch you next time on The Unofficial Guide to Partnering.